path integrals, reality, and generalizations, quantum theory. The ideas I'm going to talk about are mainly from this paper, which is just on the archive. If time permits, I might also touch on some ideas from a couple of earlier papers, but I have a fairly strong sneaking suspicion that time probably won't fix. I have to say those all the time. But if you listen to generalizations of quantum theory in a different direction, you might want to take a look at that one. Okay, why are we? Why might we be interested in working on dynamical collapse models, about which we've already heard some intriguing talks, and or other generalizations of quantum theory? I can think of at least three different reasons. One is pure theoretical, unprincipled, but pure theoretical curiosity. We have quantum theory, we want to test it as well as we can. We're just intellectually interested in any way that you can generalize quantum theory, and we're particularly interested in generalizations if they give you some motivation for carrying out new tests of quantum theory. The second line of motivation is the continuing ability to unify quantum
Let's try that again.
Second motivation, we don't know how to unify quantum theory and general relativity. Not everyone, but many people have a hunch that the problem isn't just that we haven't got a quantum theory of gravity, but that to some extent we may need to tweak or change or gravitize, alter the principles of quantum theory, as well as doing things the other way around. And the third, which I guess is the one that underlies the work I want to talk about today, is the belief in what you might call the quantum reality problem, if you're thinking ontologically, or if you want to phrase it in a way about the relationship between existing theories, the persuasion that we have no way of explaining the appearance of a quasi-classical world and the success of the classical and quasi-classical equations of motion that work so well in the world we actually see, directly, without hedging, without fudging, without illicit maneuvers, from within quantum theory, which is supposed to be our fundamental theory. If you believe that, and I guess I do believe that at present, it follows that even non-relativistic quantum theory is necessarily in need of some amendment. It's either incomplete or it's incorrect.
Our inability to explain the appearance of a quasi-classical world, which aspect of that are you concerned with? Things don't happen?
Can I postpone that question for a few slides, because I'm going to focus on it for the next few slides? One of my favorite quotations from Feynman from his Messenger lectures, which I thought was relevant to some of the discussions we were having yesterday, and certainly is relevant today. Is Feynman, in his less recognized role, is a very deep thinker about scientific progress and even ideas on the philosophy of science. I think it's worth actually going through the whole thing, because does everybody know this quote about the Mayan astronomer? So let's do it. For those people who think that the only thing that's important is that the theory agrees with experiment, I'd like to imagine, obviously, presumably fictitious, discussion between a Mayan astronomer and his student. The Mayans were able to calculate with great precision predictions, for example, for eclipses, and for the position of the moon in the sky, position of Venus, and so on. All done by arithmetic. They counted a certain number, they subtracted some numbers, and so on. There was no discussion of what the moon was, no discussion even the idea that it went around. They just calculated the time when there'd be an eclipse, when the moon would rise at the full, and so on. So now suppose a young man went to the astronomer and said, hey, look, I've got an idea. Maybe there are things out there that are going round, there are balls or something like rocks out there, and we could do the calculations, how they move in a completely different way from just going through numbers, calculating what time they appear in the sky. And the astronomer says, yes, okay, and how accurately can you predict eclipses? And the young man says, well, I haven't developed the thing very far, so yet. And the other astronomer says, well, we could calculate eclipses more accurately than you can with your model. So you mustn't pay any attention to your idea, because obviously the mathematical scheme, the stuff we already have, is better. There is a very strong tendency when somebody comes up with an idea and says, let's suppose the world is this way, for people to say to him or her, what would you get for the answer to such and such a problem? And he or she says, I haven't developed it far enough. And they say, well, we already have, much further, and we can get the answers very accurately. So it's a problem whether or not to worry about the philosophies behind ideas.
Another question. Is that actually accurate for the Mayan cosmology?
I'm not an expert on the history. I assume so, but I haven't, I can't stand here as a scholar and say I've gone through the original sources to check. Good question.
I know so little about the Mayans because everything got burned up. So I suspect that they had a much more well-developed view of the world than simply adding and subtracting numbers to each other. So I suspect this is a little fable that he made up.
It's a good question, and it'd be interesting there. But it's interesting, and this surely didn't escape Feynman's attention. It's interesting how well this fable fits quantum theory and people who are trying to go beyond quantum theory. So I want to think about path integrals, and I want to start with a very familiar picture. You've got some reasonably large, massive object. We're just going to track its center of mass motion, so we have a single path. It's going between points A and B, and here is the path of stationary action, the red one. And we know, because it's a path of stationary action, that if you take paths that are close enough nearby, S, you're at a stationary point of S, and so their phases are going to be very similar. And so you have a whole bunch of paths with similar phases round about this one. If you take a general path, something like this green one, that's well away from the stationary actionary path, and you take another nearby path, let's call it Q, the purple one, it's about as near to the green one as the orange one was to the red one, you don't expect the same thing. The action here is not very far from stationary, it's oscillating wildly. And so there's no reason to expect any clear relationship between SP over H bar, SQ over H bar. Okay. You're right that if the separation is literally almost zero, yes. But for a small infinitesimal separation, you have a distinction between the two cases. Okay, so it's Feynman quotation day. This is from Feynman and Hibbs, and it's their discussion of exactly this situation. And again, it's worth, although I think this argument is familiar to everyone, it's worth going through it carefully to be sure that I at least am not misrepresenting Feynman and Hibbs. So before making the mathematics more complete, we compare the quantum law with the classical rule. At first sight, from this equation, which is the path integral, all the paths contribute equally, although the phases vary. So it's not clear how in the classical limit some particular path becomes more important. The classical approximation, however, corresponds to the case that dimensions blah, 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 are so large that S is enormous in relation to H bar. The phase S over H is a very large angle. The real and imaginary parts of this angle are likely to be plus or minus. If we change the path by delta x, the change in S is small on the classical scale, but huge in the units of H bar. Those small changes in path typically make enormous changes in phase. We get enormous oscillations, and the total contribution will then add to zero. So that is a reason for thinking that if you take a set of paths away from this region, where this argument applies, and integrate over them, they're oscillating wildly, and the integral will be close to or equal to zero. At least so the argument runs. Therefore, no path really needs to be considered if its neighboring path is a different action. For the paths in the neighborhood cancel out the contribution. But for the special path, the stationary path, for which S is an extremum, a small change in path produces to first order no change in S. All the contributions are nearly in phase and do not cancel out. Therefore, only for paths in the vicinity of the stationary path can we get important contributions. And in the classical limit, we need only consider this particular trajectory of being importance. And I've, the boldface isn't in the original, I've added it for this next sentence. In this way, the classical laws of emotion arise from the quantum laws. I want to argue that that sentence is wrong. It's simply logically flawed. Everything up to that I have no quarrel with. And he goes on to make an interesting further comment. Trajectories which differ from the stationary path contribute as long as the action is still within H-bar. And so the classical trajectory is indefinite to this slight extent. And we have a rule which gives us some limitations on the precision of the classically defined trajectory. Properly speaking, we should talk about a set of quasi-classical trajectories rather than a single classical trajectory. Now, I'm arguing here in the path integral context for the impossibility of deriving quasi-classical physics directly from quantum physics. I know half the audience, maybe more than half the audience, believes me already. I know a respectable fraction of the audience who I'd like to carry with me doesn't believe me. So I ask for a little bit of tolerance from both sides while I go through this point in a little more depth. It gets difficult talking about path integrals because of the embarrassing fact that in almost any realistic model, we don't have a rigorous definition of the path integral. And so whatever you're talking about, it's easy to poke holes in it. I want to get around that because I want to separate out the important technical problems from defining a path integral from the conceptual issue that underlies this particular argument. And so I'm going to build a little toy path integral model where there's only finitely many paths. It's a discrete path integral model, one in which you should be able to run the Feynman-Hibbs argument. And I'm going to claim it's very clear that you cannot run the Feynman-Hibbs argument. So again, we have a finite number of paths. We therefore have no problem defining a path integral. It's just a sum. We're going to pick out a subset of those paths that mathematically have amplitudes that have properties analogous to those of the quasi-classical trajectories, the ones in the neighborhood of the stationary action path. And this is going to allow us to focus on the logic of Feynman and Hibbs's argument. Okay, I've written out a list of paths here, P1 to Pn, that's the number of paths, and amplitudes, they're equations, but it's maybe clearer on the next page because I've got a little diagram. Here's our toy model of paths for a massive object. I'm going to assume, obviously not entirely realistically, that they're not just a discrete set, but there's some sort of linear ordering on them. So this one is the furthest one out, and this one's next to it, and this one next to it, and so on, down to here. And the ones I've highlighted in orange are supposed to be the quasi-classical paths, Pm to Pm plus k. And then we get another list of paths going out. And here's the last one. This is as far out as our paths are going to go. The quasi-classical region is supposed to be small compared to the total region. So this number k is going to be a lot smaller than capital N.
You say that the phases along those paths are just plus or minus 1?
Yep. So I'm simplifying in every way possible. And yes, the phases are going to be only plus or minus 1. Yep.
So you're going to be far, all the paths are equally far from each other in phase space, in phases.
Well, no, because some of them have equal phase and some of them don't. Shall I say more about the phases because they're on the next?
Okay.
Yeah. So, Nicole, do you have a separate question?
And nearby are near, well, just close to the classical path, but it sounds like those are what you're calling quasi-classical.
Yeah.
But I associate the term quasi-classical. You're going to hear the term quantum classical maybe in between. So are you, when you say quasi-classical, do you mean just paths that are near the classical path? Or do you mean to describe some particular regime of behavior?
In this model, they are just going to be paths that are near the classical path. But the underlying intuition is, if we were thinking about a set, some massive object and trying to work out what it does, as Feynman and Hibbs already said, we're not going to be able to pick out a unique classical trajectory. In fact, quantum theory isn't going to allow, even if you believe their argument from the path integral, it's not going to produce a unique trajectory. It's going to tell you the thing moves in some path that's pretty close. So I take that to be a sort of prediction of quasi-classical physics. It's saying the thing, roughly speaking, follows the classical equation of motion with little wiggles that we're not going to say any more about, rather than what I would say was classical physics, which is the thing simply follows this classical path, end of story, no ifs, no buts, no approximations. Yeah. Is geometrically totally unrealistic, but I'm going to do it anyway because it's my toy model and I want to make a particular point within it, and I don't need to make that particular point. I don't think I need to worry about all the geometric realities of paths. But you're absolutely right. If this is not a sensible discretization of a continuous path integral. It's a much more abstract model. Okay, amplitudes. So again, I'm simplifying down pretty much as far as I think I can. The quasi-classical paths all have the same amplitude, plus one, plus one, plus one. Everywhere outside the quasi-classical region, we get as much oscillation as we can. So alternately, one and minus one, one minus one, all the way through. And again, the other side. Okay, so you'll notice, let me go back a minute. If we summed over all those amplitudes, these cancel in pairs. These cancel in pairs. Just to make things simpler, I've assumed there's an even number of paths either side of the quasi-classical region. And so the total contribution is just k plus 1, which comes from the ones in here. So nobody's going to quarrel with Feynman and Hibbs's arithmetic, certainly in this model where it's well-defined. Of course, it is true. Sum over the amplitudes of all the paths is the same thing as sum over the amplitudes of paths in the orange quasi-classical region. It's k plus 1. Let me make another obvious point. That's not just true of that set of paths. For instance, I could take the first k plus 1 odd-labeled paths, each of which is amplitude 1, so this one and this one, through to somewhere here. Pick those out. And observe, just as an arithmetic identity, the sum over all the paths is also the sum of the amplitudes for the first k plus 1 odd paths. And I could do it for any set, of course, of the size k plus 1, for which the amplitudes are plus 1. So where does that leave Feynman and Hibbs's argument? Well, I'm sure they and anybody who wants to press the argument would say I've missed out on something important here. It's certainly true that there is a distinction between the quasi-classical paths and the others in this model. The quasi-classical paths are all adjacent, the other ones aren't. So what? Nothing in the definition of the path integral, nothing in any standard presentation of its physical implications said, oh, by the way, guys, we're introducing some special ontology associated with the path integral. subsets of adjacent paths, nearby paths in some sense, they have a special ontological status. You don't find that in Feynman and Hibbs. You don't find that in any of the textbooks. But that or something like it seems to be what we'd need to run the rest of the argument. To derive a classical law of motion, or a quasi-classical law of motion, we need to be able to make a statement about the actual trajectories of macroscopic objects. And in particular here, in this toy model, we need to be able to derive from this sort of arithmetic the statement that the object follows one of the orange quasi-classical paths and not one of the others. That isn't there in standard path integral quantum theory. Well, you could give up and go home at that point, but there's so much beauty in path integral quantum theory. And there's a sort of frustration that this argument doesn't work, because it seems like it seems like a key insight that's sort of nearly there, but missing something. It seems as though it should be the germ of a really respectable and rather beautiful argument that does illuminate the connection between quantum and classical physics. So I want to take the view, since we can't make the argument run from the standard path integral, maybe it's worth exploring changing the definition of the path integral and or adding an appropriate additional ontological postulate, or both of those things. So our problems seem to be that you look at path integrals, we've all done this, it's hard not to think it's telling you that paths have probabilities, but it isn't telling you that paths have probabilities. And to the extent that you try and flesh out that intuition, you realize your intuitions start conflicting with one another. People generally like the Feynman-Hibbs argument, and so they like the intuition that that macroscopic objects follow a quasi-classical trajectory. Often the same people also like the intuition that the path integral tells you that, in some sense, the particle follows all possible paths. But those intuitions could not be more diametrically opposed. Yeah. So I want to play about with the idea of inventing a new postulate that explicitly, honestly, assigns probabilities to paths. We need some quantity, probability P. It's going to be greater than or equal to zero. It's got to be a probability. It should be less than or equal to one, of course, as well. The sum or integral over the paths of the probability equals one. And it is supposed plainly and simply to represent the probability that the given path P actually was followed. And if you take this idea seriously, if it works out, physical reality in an experiment, in principle physical reality everywhere, following the universe from start to finish, is that selected path. Okay, so please keep in mind the Mayan astronomer, the young Mayan astronomer in this discussion. I'm playing about with an idea. I'm going to show some suggestive calculations in toy models. I am not claiming that I have a complete technically or ontologically sensible theory for realistic models of quantum cosmology or even for realistic models of real experiments. Here's the postulate that I want to explore, and maybe I should leave a copy of it over here. So the probability of path is given by something that looks rather like an ordinary path integral, but with some important changes. So integral over other paths, e to minus isq, and then some extra correction factor, which depends on a quantity d. Sorry, e to the minus, there should be a modulus sign there. This thing all squared, divided by a normalization factor, e to the minus d of bq. So we'll try this. What is d? I'm going to play around with various possibilities. I do not have a unique answer for that. It's supposed to be some reasonably simple, plausibly natural way of calibrating distance between pars and P and Q. I'm not even committed to it having the properties of a metric at the moment. So, what could that give us? Well, let's go back to our toy model. Once again, we have the same list of paths. Once again, we have the quasi-classical region and the oscillatory regions either side of it. I'm going to introduce a simple distance function, about as simple as you can get. So here's the intuition. We have some scale, capital D, and the distance function is determined by that scale. This is an admittedly unrealistic model in which the paths are linearly arranged, but you're going to use that linearity and just say, this path is close to this one if they're less than D apart from each other. It's far from this one if they're greater than D apart from each other. And if it's precisely equal D, well, that's a borderline case, and I'll do something about that in a minute. And close and distant, close and distance are going to be as crudely modeled as possible. So close, I'm going to say that's D equals zero. Distance, D equals infinity.
Pn as D equals 0 from Pn minus 1.
Yes, for instance. Okay, so the idea, this is our crude distance function, which goes off to infinity sharply. It's supposed to be a model for something a bit more realistic, which might be something like e to the minus the distance between the paths, path numbers, the modulus of the difference of the path numbers. Exactly. That's it. You're ahead of me, but yes. How am I doing for time? Okay, thank you. Don't be too worried about 67. There's actually a second talk sort of stuck in the back of this one, just in case I need material from it. Okay. So our amplitudes we already have, oscillatory, constant, oscillatory. Our distance function, well, I told you about the close ones, they're distance zero. The faraway ones, distance infinity. The intermediate ones, I'm going to call distance log a half, just because there's an x spin here, so that's going to mean they contribute with weight half. They're not quite decided whether they're contributing or not. And as I said, this is crude, but you could try something a little more realistic, and I did. I think an appropriate model, you persuade yourself you get similar conclusions. The scale D still should be small compared to the total space of paths. I also want the number of paths that are away from the quasi-classical region on either side to be a lot larger than that scale. So that way and that way. Okay, well, we have a probability postulate. We can feed it in there. We get a contribution of, in this term, 1 times the amplitude, plus 1 times the amplitude for all the paths that are close, plus a contribution of half for the borderline ones, plus a contribution of 0 for the rest. And we need to normalize, so after we've worked out these expressions, we find the appropriate factor C so that we have a probability distribution. What does that give you? Well, if you think about a path here that's well away from the quasi-classical region, you take the amplitude, you multiply by the distance function factor, which is, except for the borderline ones, is going to be a series of ones like this, and that will give you at the edges, a couple of minus a halves, and in here, terms that alternate, 1 minus 1, da 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 da, minus 1, up to 1, You've got one more one than minus one, so you get plus one from these, but that's cancelled off by the two minus a half, so you get a total of zero. You've got a path well away from the quasi-classical region. According to this formula, it's got no probability of being realized. What about a path in or near the quasi-classical region? Well, of course, now things are different. Let's say the path somewhere here in, but to the sort of to a little bit towards the edge of the quasi-classical region. You get oscillatory terms contributing here, but then you get a whole sequence of plus one times plus one plus plus one times plus one blah, 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 constructive interference here. Plug in the numbers, well, you get a distinctively positive term that now depends on the various parameters in our model. And what's that really telling you? Well, this is supposed to be the list of paths. Here's the graph of their probabilities. I should confess I'm actually ignoring a little boundary, little artifacts at the boundaries, which would go away if I made n infinite. But forgetting about those, you have probability zero until you're close to the quasi-classical region. And then the probability starts ramping up over a range of k paths, where k is the width of the region. And then for the next 2d paths, it's at its maximum, where d, remember, is the scale we introduce in the distance function. And then it symmetrically ramps down again, zero over there. Okay, so you can argue about whether it's a good test of anything, but in this toy model with these toy rules, we've got a path probability postulate that succeeds in two ways where Feynman and Hibbs' argument fails. First, it actually gives us an ontology. It gives us a realist ontology. Second, the ontology explains why an approximately quasi-classical path is followed and why one that's way out in the oscillatory region isn't. Notice, to do this, we had to introduce a new parameter, d, and that's just one way of parameterizing the distance function. So really, we have to introduce some new function measuring distance between paths. Okay, so it's interesting, of course, if we're trying to understand the relationship between microscopic and macroscopic physics, to think about microscopic experiments as well as quasi-classical macroscopic systems. Well, we could use, with a slightly different parameter range, exactly the same toy model to discuss a single microscopic particle. And let's start with the simplest situation where you've got a source and you've got a particle beam which is not infinitely thin, but is reasonably well-defined. So in the sort of unrigorous but intuitive way we often talk about experiments, the particle beam goes along some well-defined path, might even be a straight line from the source to the detector. And if you did a full path integral, of course, though, you wouldn't just consider paths lying within the beam region, but general paths that are outside the beam and maybe cross it many times and do all sorts of kooky things. So, again, simplifying enormously to our toy model, if we still decide to take it seriously as an ontological guide here, it suggests that the possible realized paths need only be, are those that are d close to the beam, where d here is now much, much greater than the beam width. It's going to need to be do that, need to be in that range to reproduce the results of two or more beam interference experiments, which I'll come on to in a minute. So if we take it seriously here, it isn't telling you the particle will follow a path within the beam. It's telling you something like, well, the particle could follow a path that you'd never draw if you were thinking about the experiment. It is constrained. It's got to be d close, but d is much larger than physical parameters in the experiment. So something like this is a perfectly possible realized path. And again, here's a plot. The point is now the paths lying within the beam in this model are a rather small subset of the paths of maximum probability. But if you go far enough away, eventually the probability again falls off to zero. Okay, just to recap, we're trying for realist ontology that talks about definite paths. In the toy model, we've got one that respects such physical intuitions as we have about the situations. It definitely has the new feature, the distance function, and it's definitely the case that in general, the physically relevant paths are not those that look close to the stationary phase region in an ordinary sense, but in a new sense that we need to make precise, d close with respect to our distance function. So to do particle beam interferometry in our toy models, well, you could try something like this. Here we've got two well-constrained but not single-path beams, one of phase e to the minus I theta 0, one of phase e to the minus I theta 1. We could take those to be two separate lists of adjacent paths, e to the minus I theta, all with the same phase here, and then all with the second phase, e to minus I theta 1 here. Oscillations this side, oscillations, so to speak, in between, oscillations outside. Again, of course, Petros's point holds even more forcefully here. Realistically, you can't just divide up your paths into things that are away from this one that way, things that are between them, and things that are outside them. The geometry is more complicated. But let's stick with the simplification for now. Follow the same rule. What predictions do you get? You get to see that the number of paths in your model that correspond to a given beam correspond to the beam strength, and you reproduce quantum interference for a typical model path, providing it's close to both the beams. So for beams that are close to one another, you predict microscopic quantum interference. This is good. For beams that are not close to one another by our by our distance function, you predict decoherence. You get the probability of a path is significantly non-zero if it's close to one of the beams, but then that probability depends only on the strength of that first beam. It's significantly non-zero again if it's close to the other beam, but it can't, since the beams are far from one another, it can't be d close to both of them. And so the probability falls to zero in between, as well as either side. Yeah?
Does the distance function depend solely on some geometric thing for the trajectory, or maybe on other things, just what's the mass of the system considered?
Short answer, I don't know. You can. And I was going to comment on this. This is an idea in its early stages. I don't know. There are lots of interesting properties of the distance function you might want to explore. I don't have a strong constraint that says you should be thinking about mass rather than geometric separation, or as well as. Right? If such constraints are out there, it'd be wonderful to identify them. But I can't promise that they're out there.
So there's this neutron interferometry, and I think the interferometer is a couple of centimeters, perhaps, in size. So if D is, half a centimeter, do those neutron interferometry experiments rule out this kind of model? Or am I missing something?
No, you're not missing anything, I think. If the distance function tells you that paths for your neutrons that are separated by more than half a centimeter have large distance, then it predicts no interference. So it depends. So that's that's an empirical constraint on D.
So those experiments. So presumably you'd want to choose D as the same sort of reasoning as GRW. Right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so
you
want it to not be too big because it would correspond to some sort of intuitive notion of macroscopic, and presumably a millimeter is already quite big.
I mean, I agree with the first part. You want, if this idea has any legs, it has to distinguish between microscopic experiments where we already know you get interference and macroscopic experiments where you might be interested in seeing whether interference breaks down. I'm not sure I agree with the second. I mean, first D, of course, doesn't just have to depend on a physical scale, as Petros has already said. It can depend on mass, it can depend on time. But I guess I don't have a clear intuition that says half a centimeter is already macroscopic enough that it shouldn't be much more than half a centimeter. I don't know. But, well, for one thing, that exists in experiments, so I better not have that intuition. But I honestly don't think I would have started with that intuition anyway. The sad thing is I don't have a...
Right. I mean, that's the concern, I take it, is that for those kinds of experiments that people are describing, there aren't obvious technical constraints on how big we can make them. We're getting pretty good at those. And, mm-hmm. and there doesn't seem to be any reason, I mean, I don't know, I'm not an expert on this stuff, and maybe somebody can correct me, but there doesn't seem, from what I know, to be any reason to suppose that you know, we couldn't do neutron interferometry experiments with the two paths a mile apart or something like that.
But we haven't done it.
Right. But I mean, okay.
I agree. I mean, I think many physicists would say the same about trying to do interference with increasingly massive objects. The technology is a lot harder, and so they're much more interesting.
I mean, because when the things get increasingly massive, then you're increasing the probability of environmental decoherence. But just by putting them farther apart, you're not putting yourself in bigger danger of environmental decoherence.
But if you're looking for intrinsic decoherence,
right.
Which is the game that collapse models have been pioneering for a long, long time, and from a slightly different perspective is the game I'm exploring here. The more constraints you could find, the better. But you have to be honest about what constraints you could find. And at the moment, the only ones I have are empirical. Yeah.
For the macroscopic bodies, don't you get many factors of this e to the minus d? So then, even if the neutron could be a mile apart, maybe baseball could only be a micron apart, or
Okay, I haven't said anything about how we scale a model for one particle up to a multi-particle model. But indeed that, and again, I can't say there's a logical constraint that forces you to do that, but that's a natural thing to do. So yes, one natural postulate would be that it depends on mass as well as separation, but it's not.
No, I wasn't saying it depends on that, but if you resolve the baseball into its individual particles,
yeah.
Then you have a multi-particle, like you said, a multi-particle.
Yeah.
So you have to generalize that to the case of multi-particles.
Yes.
But one way would just be to sort of imagine for each pair of particle paths of a given particle that you introduce such a factor.
You're basically saying you use the same trick as David does in collapse models, so it's like many things collapse faster.
Yes. That's one sensible rule. It's not
an explicit mass dependence, it's just a number.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's one sensible rule. I just want to make the point, you can imagine other rules also. Okay, so we have perhaps suggestive results in very simple toy models. I don't want to say that's any guarantee that this postulate or any simple variation of this postulate with any choice of distance function will produce the holy grail that would please mainstream quantum physicists, as well as people interested in altering quantum theory, of a rigorously defined version of a path integral in continuous realistic models. This is a starting point from which one might start to explore those questions, but I have nothing to say on those questions today, except for ideas which you could take or leave. It's worth noting, at least, that things that you'd think anyway are natural choices of distance function do look as though they would start to suppress contributions from some of the sort of powers that you find embarrassing in the path integral. Here's a reasonably sensible, maybe nearly quasi-classical path from A to B. Here's a rather pathological one that's wildly oscillating all over the place. Well, if your distance function is sensitive to distance in the physical sense, the contribution of this one to this is going to be hugely suppressed. If it's sensitive to curvature or other measures of the derivative, it's going to be even more suppressed given the behavior of this thing. It's a thought to play with, though. I'd say no more than that. And there are a few other similarly ill or well-formed thoughts that set out in the archive paper, which you could take a look at. I have to stress, I just don't know. I don't know if any of these produces rigorously defined path probabilities in realistic continuous models. So I'm giving you, why am I talking about this? Well, I think it's interesting to pin down as explicitly as possible the flaws in the Feynman-Hibbs argument. I find the toy models suggestive, and I think it's an interesting way of quantum, thinking about quantum theory. If your worry is that you've got a conceptual problem that you can't see a way around, even if you reduce it to an incredibly hard, perhaps impossible technical problem, it gives some encouragement that your problem wasn't a conceptual one. You've got a technical difficulty now. Can we define in realistic models path integrals that make these modified expressions rigorously defined? I've already given you Feynman on the virtues of suspending judgment on research programs. I wanted to add the Danish poet Piet Hein, put up in a place where it's easy to see the cryptic admonishment TTT, and you feel how depressingly slowly you climb. It's well to remember that things take time. And I think perhaps many of us in this community should draw some moral encouragement and support from Piet Hein on this. I also wanted to say, just to reinforce the point about the difference between conceptual and technical problems. Technically, I have no idea whether this works in Minkowski or Lorentz spacetimes. But there certainly isn't any conceptual problem defining a relativistic version of distance. You can find perfectly natural-looking distance measures that are generally covariant between pairs of paths. Just to take one example, something that depends on the maximum space-like separation. To be precise, if one of these paths is causal, something like this looks perfectly sensible. And the same is true in multiparticle configuration spaces, in field configuration paths, perhaps even paths in geometry space, and ideas of quantum gravity. So you're at liberty to do what you want with this, but if you do take this idea seriously, at the moment, we have no strong constraints on the distance function. If you take this seriously, even as only a metaphor, unless and until stronger constraints are found, it suggests something that's both perhaps from one perspective scientifically discouraging, from another perspective nonetheless scientifically correct, that we should be looking to test quantum interference pretty much without prejudice in any unexplored range that's defined by parameters that might possibly be natural in some reformulation that uses something like this. So just to touch on a few examples, as people have already mentioned, you could worry about the maximum separation of beams, but also the average separation. You could worry about the length of time for the separation. Things can depend on the mass of the object, and so on. It's a, I take this as offering weak but broad range support to technologists who are trying to push tests of quantum theory in any new direction. And again, at the conceptual level, ontologically, we don't seem to have any worries about the principle of this idea. If it works, great. There's no double ontology. The wave function just isn't fundamental here. Path integral formalism is the right way to think about quantum theory. The ontology is a path ontology. One path is randomly chosen. There's no issue of tails in the wave function because we don't fundamentally have a wave function. There's no double ontology with the wave function. Same reason. And I think that's probably a good place to stop. So thank you very much for listening tolerantly and asking questions.